Hey guys, welcome to the Vanatic Podcast, brought to you by Casper Outdoors. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey guys, here. Welcome back to the Vanatic Podcast. This week we've got a very special guest. We've got John LaCourte here with Tracked Optics. John, appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thanks, Derek. Glad to be here.
Well, guys, I don't know if you know about Tracked and stuff, but we've been working with John and the guys at Tracked for, gosh, John, I don't know, it's been 4 or 5 years since we met?
Yeah. Yep. We met, I think, at a Texas Trophy Hunter show.
Oh, man, that's been a long time coming. But
yeah.
Well, tell us, and so what's cool about you guys, what kind of caught our eye when we first saw you was really like you've got you can see a Tracked optic and you know it's a Tracked optic. You've got your special track gray and you can easily identify it, and you see pictures and stuff on Instagram, people using your product. But Tracked's, you know, not really where you guys got started in the optic space, right?
No. My partner, John Allen, and I both worked for Nikon Sport Optics for many, many years. We worked in the sport optics division of Nikon. Nikon, obviously, very well known for cameras, basically a global brand when it comes to photography. But they also had a sport optics division that manufactured rifle scopes, binocular spotting scopes, and rangefinders. So John was kind of more on the sales side. I was more on the marketing and product development side. And, you know, Nikon kind of was deciding to kind of move in a different direction and, you know, get out of the hunting and shooting market just because of the, you know, anti-hunter feedback they would get on the camera side. And John and I saw the writing on the wall and, you know, decided to leave the company and start Track Optics. And, you know, the thing that we are doing different as an optics manufacturer is we only sell our products directly to the consumer. We don't offer our products through stores or distributors. The only place you can really buy our products is through our website. And the reason we do that is because, you know, today optics markup is greater really than it ever has been before. Big markups at the retail stores. And the reason for that is, you know, there are certain items in those big box stores that, you know, they don't make a lot of money on. They've got to find items that they can make a lot of money on. And right now, the biggest markups are on clothing and accessories. And obviously, optics is one of those accessories. You know, the rifle and ammunition part of the business has always been a little bit tighter. So that just gave us, you know, a thought process to build a company that focuses 100% on the consumer. Is not worried about satisfying a big box store and their margins. And, you know, if they open up a new store, you have to support that store. And they're always looking for additional, you know, funds to run their business. And, you know, you have to keep increasing their profit. You can't raise the retail price. So what ends up happening is you start having to sacrifice the quality of the product in order to get the numbers to work to satisfy these dealers and distributors. And, you know, when you take a step back and you think about that, as a manufacturer, your goal should be working every single day to make a better situation for the consumer, the end user. Because at the end of the day, if you don't have them, you have nothing. You know, you can stock all the products you want into these big box stores. If nobody's buying them, you're out of luck. So yeah. I know that was a very long-winded response, but, you know, that's really kind of what our vision was, to, you know, to just do things different, disrupt the market a bit. And, you know, it's a monstrous market. You know, today there's more optics manufactured than there ever have been before. You know, 20 years ago, there were probably a handful to choose from. And, you know, I've been a lifelong hunter and shooter. So I've, you know, had the benefit of, you know, trying a lot of different products, not only in the optics world, but, you know, firearms and ammunition. We, you know, established some great relationships. It's an exciting time for us.
So tell me, you know, so before we get into how you developed and, like, you know, the features of you know, Tracked specifically, you know, you're talking about growing up hunting. Where did you grow up, and how was that? How did that influence you in getting into the, you know, the outdoor space?
Well, that's a great question, and I actually grew up in New York, right on the border of Brooklyn and Queens.
So there's a lot of hunting there.
Yeah, there is, but not game. But people say to me all the time, how did you ever get into this, industry? Being that you really lived in an area where, basically we had to drive 4 hours to get to where we hunted. But my grandfather came here from Italy in the early 1900s, and the first thing that he did was buy a piece of property, in upstate New York, so my father and uncle could learn to hunt and shoot and live the outdoor lifestyle. And my father passed that down to me. And so I tell people all the time, I was a city boy Monday through Friday. Late Friday night, the whole family would jump in the car, we'd drive upstate to our house and property, and I was a country boy Saturday and Sunday for my whole life.
That is
Not just
awesome.
hunting season. We spent, the winters we would snowmobile, the spring we would turkey hunt, we'd spend our summers up there, we had a pond, and obviously the fall was big game hunting time. And during the months of October, November, and December, the LaCourte men were nowhere to be found because we were hunting.
That's
It
all.
didn't matter whether there was a wedding or a communion or whatever. We were not going to be around on the weekend. And we had very, very supportive wives and families, and they understood the passion that goes into this sport. And that's the thing that I really feel a lot of people that don't hunt or don't really even have an understanding of why we hunt. They don't understand the passion that's involved, the respect for the environment, the respect for the animal, the dedication. And to top that off, whether you're hunting with archery equipment or firearms, there's a level of responsibility that goes along with firearm handling that no other sport can really show a young person. I've been involved in sports my whole life. My kids are involved in sports, but if you miss a shot at the end of the game, from the foul line, it's not the end of the world. But if that rifle discharges when it shouldn't, that could be a very, very dangerous situation. So the level of responsibility that shooting and hunting brings to an individual, I think does nothing but help that person in every other aspect of their life.
Yeah, and that is very well said. And it's kind of, teed up here. That's why we call this a Fanatic Podcast, all things related to hunting. And you nailed it. And you're talking about being a marketing and branding. It's all about the experience, right? And you're seeing there's a lot of brands that are doing that well. But yeah, it's become less and less about the product, and then how does that product, get you that experience or more time, with that experience. And so that's really cool. Yeah, I mean, we've and the way you put it in terms of young people, it really is important to me, because I've got a nine, well, actually, he'll be about to be 10 this week, a year old boy. And we've, he's been shooting and hunting his whole life. And like you said, you grow up around it. There's not fear for it, against it, and there's a responsibility, around it. And so it's just, it's an interesting, part of family blood and, kind of family culture. And so I did not know that about you. That's super, super cool. And so you come from like a long legacy of hunters on a specific property. That's pretty cool. So then when from there, obviously that grafted, your personality and you how did you translate that into, was Nikon your first position in the outdoor industry?
Yeah, it was. I was working at a wholesale meat and seafood distributing company. I was an office manager, and it's just kind of one of those jobs that really wasn't challenging, wasn't really exciting. It was just a day to day. I earned a good living, but I just wasn't happy. And I asked my girlfriend, who's my wife now, she was working in Manhattan, to pick up the Wall Street Journal, because that's where a lot of jobs were advertised in. She brought the paper home, and I threw it down on my coffee table, and I didn't even look at it for a few days, and went to work. I had just a lousy day. I came home, and I flipped the paper open to the ads, and the first thing I saw was an ad that said Nikon marketing hunting. And I about fell off, my couch, because, again, living where I live and even thinking about having a job related to the hunting and shooting industry was just, it was just so far out of my thought process. I never even considered it. But you know, I sent in a resume. I went for an interview, and you know, I was hired that day. And you know, it was just one of those situations that I think really was by the hand of God, because I was in a situation where I needed a change. Nikon was looking for a person that had management, marketing, and hunting experience, which, you know, again, in Brooklyn, Queens, New York, yeah, probably not a lot of people.
Small population, yeah.
There's a ton of hunters on, you know, what I call Long Island, which is where I live now. But a lot of them are not necessarily in the marketing and management field. You know, they're more, you know, blue collar workers, you know, plumbers, and you know, so the whole management, marketing, and the fact that you know I did have a hunting background, just, it was just a perfect fit.
That's awesome.
And you know, it was a heck of a ride. I worked there for 15 years, and you know, we brought a brand from being virtually unknown to being one of the top players, you know, in the optics market. And, you know, a lot of that was due to good quality products and innovation and new items. But a lot of it was the partnerships, you know, that we had established, whether it be with, you know, Realtree or Buckmasters or, you know, Thompson Center. We created these synergies that really, really worked. And, you know, that again, that path led us in a direction where, again, Nikon was just not wanting to stay in that market. And, you know, that was fine because it opened the door for this, you know, phenomenal opportunity for us to start Tracked.
Man, that is, was so cool about that story and how you get in. I've been asking people that a lot because, you know, for me, that was, you know, growing up was, I just, how do you get in the outdoor industry? How do you get in the outdoor industry? That's like what drove me to, you know, to kind of do what we did and get here and take the job at Bowtech. But it's like everybody, including myself, has kind of a similar-ish story. It's like it always seems to be, you know, somewhat divine and has stumbled into this, or like I was talking with the guys at Onyx, it was last week or week before, and Dylan kind of said the same thing. He was like, I just sort of ended up at this place, and all of a sudden, you know, Onyx is this huge known space, and he's in, you know, Western marketing manager. And so it's always fun when somebody's like, why do I get in that industry? It's really hard to say, go do this, and then you can be in the outdoor industry. But what I love about it, though, is once you're kind of in it, it's like, we always joke, it's, you know, we work with the same 30 people we've worked with for 10 years. It's just everybody jumbled around in different places, you know, so it's kind of fun. So you talk a lot about good quality product and sponsorships. And so when you know, in looking at that product from those kind of lenses, when you went to develop Tracked in the optics space, like, where did you start and what was the most important, I guess, baseline thing as you developed this optics brand?
Well, you know, we had relationships with all of the subcontractors that Nikon was using because, you know, for the most part, you know, the folks in Japan that we worked with, who were really kind of the go-between, you know, us and the subcontractors, they weren't hunters or shooters. So when the factory had questions about a product, hey, you know, why? Why do you want this done? Or you know, what's your idea? They're very inquisitive, but the folks in Japan, in Nikon Japan, they couldn't answer those questions. So they would end up directing those questions, you know, to me. You know, we'd go to SHOT Show, and these subcontractors would visit me because they wanted to, you know, answer to the questions that they had. So we had pre-established relationships, you know, with, you know, all of the subcontractors that, you know, we felt were, you know, of a high level quality that can produce the product that we wanted to produce. You know, Nikon obviously made a great product. They still make binoculars and rangefinders, you know, but a lot of their business was based upon hitting price points.
Yeah.
And, you know, in order to hit price points, you have to sometimes, many times, make sacrifices. So John and I developed a business plan where we decided to build products that we did not make sacrifices. We built the product to the level we felt the product should be and then put a fair price on it. You know, when we were at Nikon, we were basically saying, okay, we need to build this rifle scope at $399. And, you know, what can we get for $399? So that meant we, you know, could do this, but we couldn't do that. And, you know, it became a little bit of a chess game. And again, at the end of the day, all we were doing was working to satisfy the retailer, the consumer who, you know, really wanted a zero stop and wanted better clicks and higher light transmission, you know, they were left out because, you know, what they wanted was not the concern. It was, what does the dealer want and what is the price it has to be? So we basically wiped the slate clean and we said, this is what we're going to do. We're, you know, all of our Toric products use shot high transmission glass. You know, that's the same glass the high-end European companies use, but we can put it in our product. And our competitors, because they're crunched for, you know, that very large markup that the retailer has to have to run their business, well, you know, that could be anywhere between 30 to 40, in some cases even 50% by the time you add, you know, the two-step process that might be involved between a distributor and a dealer. So think about that for a second. So, you know, you're a manufacturer, okay? You have to sell it to a distributor. They have to make a profit. The distributor has to sell it to the dealer, the big box store, the mom and pop. There's another markup there. And then they sell it to the consumer. So in some cases, you have two levels of profit that have to be achieved before the product gets to the consumer. Well, by selling direct, we build the product, we sell it right to the consumer. We're able to give them a better quality product for the money.
Yep.
And that's really what separates us, you know, from a lot of the competition out there is, you know, when someone goes out and buys a Toric rifle scope, what they're getting for their money is actually going to be able to compete with products costing hundreds of dollars more. And, you know, the feedback that we get is extremely humbling. You know, you take a look at the ratings and the reviews on the website, and we're partners with Trustpilot, who is a review center that people can go to just check on, you know, products and how they perform. And it's really humbling that when people, you know, pick up the phone and call you and say, hey, you know, I wasn't sure about your company. I know you guys are new. I took a chance. I bought a scope. Looking at the specs, I figured it was going to be good. I didn't think it was going to be this good.
But yeah, we've heard that on our side, on the rifle building side. Because like I said, I mean, most of the time, we're not, we do provide scopes. Somebody wants scopes. A lot of times people are bringing us scopes. And we've seen a couple customers specifically, it's been fun, actually build the theme of their rifle, the colors, the flutes, or whatever, around matching one of your scopes. You know, oh, I've got, you know, a ton of them. I like this color. I love this scope. So let's build a rifle that sort of matches my scope, which a lot of times that's not how people think about it. So it's you know, like I said, I do, you know, like I said, it's been fun. We've used a lot of them. And so you guys have got a good thing going. So when you look at that, like, you know, going into long range space and with some of the stuff that you guys have done on the newer products, what do you see, or what would you tell somebody that called you up and say, what is important for me to have, you know, and what, you know, how do you guys stack up in those features?
From everybody's perspective, it might be a little different. You know, you have to be able to see what you're shooting at. You know, if you can't see what you're shooting, you know, the rifle scope really doesn't perform its function. So it's got to be bright and clear. And I'm not going to say it's second, because it's not. Both of these things are, in my opinion, equally important, but the scope has got to be durable. It's got to hold zero. The turrets need to track perfectly. If your scope doesn't do both of those, then it's not performing the actual concept of what a rifle scope is supposed to do. It's a sighting device. It's for you to be able to sight the target and have your bullet impact where you want it to. You know, there's people that say, oh, I don't use a binocular, I've got a rifle scope. You should never use your rifle scope to do anything other than to point it at something you intend to destroy. It's not designed for judging, you know, how many points a buck has. While people do that, that's not what it's designed for. It's designed for you to place the bullet where it needs to go. Whether you're target shooting or whether you're big game hunting, that's what the purpose of the scope is. So it's got to be able to do those things. It's got to be able to see well in low light. It's got to be able to resolve the image so you can make sure that you're actually placing the crosshair exactly where it needs to be. and it needs to be able to, perform under adverse conditions, whether it's cold or hot or raining or snowing. If it, gets bumped around and, on your quad, it's gotta have all those
Yeah.
features.
So when you go through all of that, how do you test that stuff? So in scope development, I've always wondered that, like when you're looking at, let me ask it this way. I'm a consumer. I'm listening to this podcast, and I've got an optic that I want to know if it's, does it click right? Is it repeatable? Like, how do you guys recommend people testing, your turrets, repeatability, whether it's tracking correctly, those kind of things?
So, if you don't mind, I'll answer that from a manufacturer standpoint, and then I'll answer it from a consumer
Perfect.
standpoint. From a manufacturer standpoint, we build scopes to certain specifications. So, all of our scopes are built to withstand 1,000 G's of force.
Wow.
That is basically greater than any center fire generates. So, even a 458 lot in a lightweight rifle is not going to generate 1,000 G's. So the scope is built to withstand just about any recoil. A lot of people say, well, what about the 50 BMG? Well, I mean, most 50 BMGs are braked and they weigh a ton. So the actual recoil force of a 50 BMG is not as much as it is in, a 458 lot in, a Ruger 77. So, that's the thing. Recoil is a very funny thing in that it can destroy scopes that are not manufactured to high levels of
We
tolerance.
see
So,
that. I mean, to echo that point, we see that with the lightweight 300 PRCs is brutal on lots of stuff. And so, to echo your point there, we've seen some optics that have been destroyed because of the, 5, 6 pound 300 PRCs.
Yeah, I mean it's mechanical. So anything mechanical can fail. Anybody that will tell you, oh, I buy X rifle scope because it'll never fail me. That's wishful thinking, but I can guarantee you that every brand of rifle scope has products that fail. It's just the way it is with mechanics. You want to minimize that. You want to choose a company that obviously, puts a lot of onus on making sure that that product will not fail. But from a consumer standpoint, you have to spend a good amount of time behind the rifle to make sure that it's doing what it should do. We get, consumers calling up all the time saying, "Hey, my scope's not holding zero." And we obviously take their word for it, but in most cases it's not the scope. In a lot of cases, it's the mounts. They're not mounting the scope properly. If you tighten the rings too much, it actually compresses the tube. It may not be denting it, but it's putting enough pressure where the erector assembly inside the scope is not allowed to move properly. That'll cause issues. We actually use a company called Box to Bench Targets, and they sell MOA and MRAD targets that you need to set up, it's got to be exactly 100 yards, and you actually fire a group, at a certain point on the target, and then there's graduations on the target that, for example, 5 MRAD, 10 MRAD, and so on and so forth, so that you can actually shoot the rifle, make your adjustments, and make sure that your rifle is actually doing what the scope should be doing, The thing about it is, I don't have to tell this to you, but you need a very accurate rifle, and you need to be a competent shooter. You're not going to be able to tell minute differences if the gun is not super accurate and you're not, a accomplished shooter. I see all the time on Facebook, these guys are posting targets and, they're not happy that the gun is not shooting a one hole group at, 100 yards and, there is a limit to what a firearm can do, and there's a limit what the person can do. And everything in your setup, your scope has a tolerance, your rings have a tolerance, your base has a tolerance, your receiver has a tolerance, your ammunition has a tolerance. So you've got, whatever that was, five different variables before we even bring in the shooter.
Right,
And
exactly.
You know, I know you do too. I spend a lot of time at the range, and you know, I make it a point to just watch other people and see what they're doing. And you know, you can see that there's people out there that need more practice.
Yeah, well, that it's interesting. We were literally having the same discussion, customer service wise internally the other day. And what's so hard about it is, I think we grew up in a place where it's like, I'm a hunter, I've done it for 30 years, I know everything, right? Where it's like, and then you've got shooters on the other side who are a PRS shooter, and they've, have, not trying to single anybody out, but they know everything, right? So it's like, I don't think, kind of what I've learned in this space is nobody knows everything, but if you just listen, you can learn a lot from a lot of people. Like we're talking about, people we've talked on the podcast, you guys, like ourselves, where it's like, we do this every day, right? We shoot lots of guns. And so, you so much of what we see is exactly what you're saying, shooter form, right? So, inconsistencies and where are you, the biggest one I see all the time is where you shoulder the rifle. A lot of guys shoulder in the pocket or out, get a lot of torque on the rifle. The other thing we see quite a bit, you talk about mounting everything and checking tracking correctly, but it's the levelness of the scope. So a lot of guys don't think about how much cant, makes a huge difference when you're shooting at distance, right? So, why are you using bubble level? Well, go take a rifle out, shoot it level at 100 yards, and then go shoot it level at 1,000, and then just bubble off, shoot another shot, and just see, you could be as much as, 10, 12 inches off just by how you are manipulating that firearm. So, agreed. It's I wish we could somehow get a community where it's like, hey, man, let me go to the range and let me just let me give you some pointers on what you're doing here or there. It's like we allow people to do that in our you mentioned other sports. It's like for a coach to come in and say, hey, change your free throw form a little bit here and there. But man, try and tell somebody to change their trigger pull a little bit.
Yeah, and obviously we're humans, we're men, and it's not easy to admit maybe when you're not doing something right.
Right.
And it's a touchy situation because like you said, that there's people out there that are very experienced. It doesn't mean that you might be missing something. I had it just the other probably 2 weeks ago, a gentleman, very experienced shooter, but could not figure out why his gun was all over the place. And, just talking to him, we were going over this and just said, have you checked your action screws? And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, the screws that hold the stock to the rifle. And he's like, no, I've never checked them. I've never had to check them. Long story short, the action was like shaking in the stock. And he literally was on the phone with him. And he was like, I can't believe it. I don't know how I didn't notice this while I was shooting. And sure enough, he, tightened them to the, the specs, and I think it was 65 inch pounds, and, went back out to the range a few days later and called me up and was like, found the problem, so.
And we saw that exact same thing this last week, and it's so interesting, because you can buy a fat wrench, a cheap torque wrench is something that, it doesn't seem like a lot of people have. It's like, man, it's what, 20 bucks, 30 bucks? And if you're going to take your gun apart and clean it, if I put it back at the right, the right specs. And I don't know. I think you're on that forum too. The 6.5 PRC Facebook group. It's very active.
Yeah.
There was a guy this morning with a Bergera, or maybe it was yesterday, and it, had it circled. It was like, oh, found my problem. It's front action screw on a Bergera.
Yeah. Actually, I saw that. Yep. So it's, it's interesting, but listen, the thing about shooting is, when something goes wrong, the first thing most shooters blame is the scope.
Yep, that's very true.
It's just the way it is. It's just, hey, something's wrong with the scope.
Yep.
Okay. But, it could, like I said, it's just so many variables. But, listen, thankfully, we have an extremely low defect rate. And if there's a problem, we personally test it.
That's cool.
And when I say we personally test it, it gets mounted on a rifle and it gets shot.
Yep.
We're not putting it on a collimator or something to simulate recoil. No, it's getting put on a gun and fired.
Yep.
And that's at the end of the day, you know, if I could show you a three-shot group with, you know, three holes touching, then the scope is holding zero, and we've got to try to figure out what the problem is, because we've eliminated that one variable. And you listen, we're willing to help you, you know, go as far as you need to figure it out. But, you know, and again, there's, you know, there's tools out there that can help you. You know, I think it's just common nature for us to tighten screws as tight as we can get them. And that is extremely counterproductive when you are mounting a rifle scope. Yep. And, you know, again, you're gonna compress the tube. You could actually crimp the tube. And this is the type of stuff that, you know, I mean, you know, guys are, they're handy, you know, they know how to, you know, do things. But when you mount a scope, there is a way to do it correctly. And there's a way to do it where it can affect the accuracy of the rifle. Yep. So, you know,
so what do you see happening? You know, one thing I was wanting to ask you guys, like, you know, I guess if you want to call it trend, but, you know, the long range deal has blown up, right? Really, if you look over the last 10 years, 15 years, but what are you seeing in the optics side in terms of, I know a lot of people are buying turret scopes or tall turret scopes, you know, are you seeing consumers really learning how to use those now, or are you still seeing? I would argue there was a time frame where people just bought them because that's what was, you know, the internet was saying, buy an adjustable turret scope, whether the guy really needed it or not, based on his hunting situation. But are you seeing people become more educated about that, or is there a place that you would tell people, hey, you know, if you've got one of our optics and you're wanting to learn about, you know, how turrets work, how ballistics work, is there a good place to send people?
That's a great question. You know, long range shooting is definitely a huge, huge growth factor for us. You know, when we started the business, we were really focused on the hunting market because that's really where Nikon was. Nikon really did not succeed. It didn't really have a lot of offerings for the target shooter, the PRS guy. Our best-selling products are, you know, the higher magnification scopes, which, you know, from a standpoint, you know, people definitely want more magnification. There's no question about that. But, you know, it seems like, you know, maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago, most people would be fearful to touch their turret once they sighted their rifle in.
100%.
You know, I know my dad and my uncle, once they sighted their gun in, they wouldn't even think of dialing it for a longer shot. You know, I mean, we hunted in New York here, so most of the shots were fairly close. But, you know, most hunters, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, they sighted their rifle in. They'd maybe check it each year before hunting season, but they definitely did not feel comfortable turning them. And scopes have come a long way in the last 20 years. So, you know, today, you know, any scope you purchase should be able to track, which means, you know, you dial that turret, it should move the amount that you're dialing, and it should come right back to the point where you started. I think that fear is mostly gone. Of, you know, a fear of dialing because you're not going to be able to get back to your zero, where it's too difficult to zero. You know, I mean, I remember, you know, starting out with, you know, loophole scopes that had, you know, friction.
I was about to say, my first gun has got a friction turret.
How much was I moving it? You know, you'd be going back and forth and back and forth and trying to find the right spot. But, you know, that's a long time ago. Things have changed where, you know, you make a two-click adjustment, that bullet should move, you know, two clicks, depending upon the value of the scope. So, you know, I think there's no question that, you know, and people are looking to shoot further, not only in hunting, but obviously the steel PRS, ELR, you know, and they need to be able to dial. So it definitely has grown, you know, tube diameter is a big thing. You know, when we started out, we didn't have any 30-millimeter or 34-millimeter scopes. Everything was one inch. But, you know, as our customer was saying, you know, would say to us, hey, you know what, you guys need to do this, you need to do that. And, you know, that's the one benefit of being a direct-to-consumer brand is, you know, when a customer has a recommendation, they come right to you. You hear it right from them. You know, when we were at Nikon, you know, customer would tell the guy behind the counter, the guy behind the counter would tell the buyer would tell the sales rep would tell one of us.
Maybe.
It's like the game of telephone.
Yeah.
You know, if I say something to you, by the time it goes through five people and gets back to me, the message has changed.
Yep.
So you're not getting the same info.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, thankfully, it really allowed us to build what, you know, people are asking us for. You know, but, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, there's people that will say, well, you know, I need a 30 millimeter tube. Well, you know, why? Well, why do you need a 30 millimeter tube? Well, it's brighter. It's brighter, brighter than a 1-inch tube. Well, you know, anyone that truly understands optics knows that the tube diameter has zero effect on light transmission. You know, you're basically looking at, you know, this section of the scope, okay, about five and a half inches of the tube. That's not where light transmission comes from. You know, the benefit of a 30 millimeter tube or a 34 millimeter tube is twofold. The first and really the most important is the larger tube gives you a wider adjustment range so you could dial out further. And if it's a true 30 millimeter or 34 millimeter erector assembly like we use, then the lenses are larger, which means it can enhance the ability to see detail, especially at those higher magnifications. So those are the benefits, but most people don't realize what the benefits are. And you know, there's a gentleman out there, his tag is Dark Lord of Optics. His name is Ilya Koshkin. And he's a private individual that I believe he's an optical engineer, and he knows more about optics than anybody I've met in the almost 30 years that I'm in this business. You know, he's got a website.
I'm gonna write that down.
He's got a forum that you could join, and he's very honest. If he likes something, he's going to tell you. If he doesn't like it, he's going to tell you. He has no affiliations, you know, or sponsorships or anything like that. And he just loves optics. He loves shooting and hunting. And, you know, he will tell you. And this is a guy that has an education based upon optics, that a 30 millimeter tube does not transmit any more light than a 1-inch tube. And a 34 does not transmit any more light than a 30. And that's optical fact. But, you know, trying to, you know, change people's mind about that is very difficult. You know, we get people all the time, you know, I'm building an ultra lightweight mountain rifle. You know, what scope do you recommend? Well, you know, then I'm going to recommend a lightweight, you know, mid magnification scope.
Yep.
Well, no, I need a 30 millimeter. Well, if you're building a lightweight rifle, why would you want the added weight of a 30 millimeter if you're getting the same magnification?
Yep.
And you're not dialing, you know, you're only shooting out to, you know, 400 or 500 yards, you know, you could use a bullet drop reticle for that, or you could dial the, you know, the cap turret. You know, that's the thing that people don't realize. People think they need an exposed turret in order to dial.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the way. You know, I could. This is just. So I could literally just take this turret off and dial it.
Yep.
It's going to work the same way as an exposed turret. I just take the cap off.
Yep.
So, you know, every scope is designed to be able to be, you know, dialed.
Yep.
But a lot of people think, oh, I need a scope that, you know, doesn't have a cap on it. It's an exposed turret like that, that I could just go and dial. And that's why we offer both. There's hunters that, you know, don't want an exposed turret for whatever reason. You know,
my personal preference, I always want a capped windage. I do like the exposed top turret with the zero stop, but you know, that's just how I use, you know, do it. And I don't, you know, we do a lot of CDS turrets for people, or dial two turrets, but I don't personally use them, to be totally honest. And I don't really recommend them if you've got a good system, whether it's a Kestrel or, you know, if you're traveling a lot. I've seen it be more of a limiter than an actual, you know, benefit. Or like I'm messed with ammo quite a bit, so it's like, well, if I'm going to change the ammo after the next 20 rounds, I don't want to cut a turret, you know. So it's been interesting. That's, you know, how I you know, sort of prefer to set that up.
Well, I'm sorry, you know, that's another point about, you know, custom engraved turrets, and we have a partnership with Kenton Industries that, you know, you could have a custom turret made for any of our scopes. But the thing to keep in mind, and this is where I think a lot of people don't realize that a custom turret is limited to one very specific atmospheric condition. So if you're, you know, shooting at 70 degrees sighting in, and then you're going on a hunt up in, you know, Saskatchewan, Canada, and it's, you know, 20 degrees, well, that 50 degree difference in temperature is going to change your ballistics. And that's why, you know, a lot of the really experienced shooters, you know, they're just dialing the minutes or milliradians right on the turret and not having it custom engraved. Because like you said, you know, what if look at the times we're in right now. Let's say you can't get the bullet that you're hand loading. You just can't get it. You can't find it anywhere. Well, now you've got to go out and use a different bullet with maybe a different weight and a different ballistic coefficient. And, you know, if you're concerned about accuracy, then, you know, that custom turret is set up for the bullet that you can't get your hands on. So, you know, they're great if, like you said, if you're pretty consistent in where you're hunting and the temperatures, they're golden.
And what I've seen kind of like in our sort of golden rule is like if you're inside of less than 1,000 foot change in elevation and less than about, you know, 30-ish degrees of temperature and you're shooting less than 500 yards,
yeah,
pretty good.
You're good.
You know, but I've seen, which crazy, people don't believe it. If you jump on a ballistic app, like JM Ballistics has got a cool one online, you can do spin and twist rates and all kinds of different things, barrel twist rates and rotations. But if you just plug in, you know, what your gun's doing and then drop the raise the elevation, drop the temperature and look at, you know, 600 yards. I mean, we're talking, we ran in one the other day trying to show somebody. I mean, it was like almost a foot difference at, you know, 700 yards just going from where we're at to, you know, northern Colorado, right? Especially, like you mentioned, that's the one thing I think people miss the most is I sighted this gun in and I chronographed it and we're in Texas and it's 100 degrees. I'm going to use this gun at 30 degrees, you know? And that's it's really interesting. Of course, and I've, you know, it's an extra piece of gear to carry, but I love the Kestrels and just Bluetooth it to the binoculars. And what I like more than anything about it is I use the high-low wind feature. So we'll catch it, and it'll say, okay, your wind is running from 3 to 7. And it gives you a high and a low. And I have really light crosshairs that have tick marks, you know, on the wind side. And so then you can kind of look at it and say, okay, if the wind is gusting, I'm going to hit here. If it's not, I'm going to hit here. And is that an ethical, reasonable shot to take? And you know, sort of using the wind hash marks as a, you know, as a grid on the animal to say, hey, yeah, this is within reason of making a good shot, you know, versus I kind of gotten, had a good friend of mine in Africa kind of really show me that. He worked with Carl Zan, the Precision Rifle Blog, and we were really talking about how to use those correctly. Because so much of the time, I think you have guys that be like, oh, cool, well, the wind's blowing from this hash mark to this hash mark. I'm on the deer all the time. Pull the trigger. Well, you know, and it kind of got to be a turnoff when you see a lot of people, you know, brisket shotting or, you know, flank shooting stuff. And that doesn't give long range a good name, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned that, you know, about the fact that you like a capped windage and, you know, exposed elevation, and ironically, we just brought out some scopes specifically designed cool that way this year. And you know, the idea behind it is, you know, most guys are not dialing wind; yep. They're holding the reticle for wind. And the reason for that is because, you know, wind is variable.
Yep.
You know, you might be using your wind meter, and it might be telling you what the wind is at where you are, but you know, the wind can change, you know, all the way out to the target, and it also might stop or slow down. So, you know, when you're dialing the correction in on windage, I think it creates, you know, an unknown that, you know, is very hard to calculate. You know, for me and just the long range shooting that I've done and the instructors that I've worked with is, you know, it's all come down to experience and time and shooting in windy conditions, and you get, you know, somewhat of a feel for it. And you know, we used to shoot in Illinois at a place called Passa Park, and it's a 600 yard range, and I don't have the footage anymore, but we actually documented where they had wind flags every 200 yards.
Oh,
and at 200 yards, a flag was left to right. At 400 yards, it was right to left. And at 600 yards, it was back to left to right. And it was in this little valley. So the wind literally was going, you know, opposite direction every 200 yards. And, you know, trying to hit targets in windy conditions there was really challenging. But, you know, you learned a lot.
Yep.
So, you know, that's the one thing about long range shooting that, you know, is, you know, it's not something that's 100% scientific like elevation adjustment is, because, you know, again, the variable nature of wind.
Yep. Well, and that's what, you know, you tell people all the time, it's the up and down is math. And math is math, and that's calculatable. It's the thing that makes a good shooter and a great shooter is exactly what you talked about, is the wind. And I don't know any other way to do it besides, oh, it's windy today, I'm not going to the range. No, it's windy today, let's go to the range once the gun is set up. You know, my probably most humbling experience on wind, we were in Africa shooting at Klipspringer, and it was like 720 yards, which is a small target. We had a Creedmoor that was just shooting incredibly well, but we were in a bowl canyon and kind of a top shooting down across to the other side of the bowl canyon. And man, I thought I had the wind right. I do this a lot, right? Boom, and I miss probably 3 feet behind the animal. And you go back and look at the film, you can see the bullet just drag off, just terrible. And I look over, and the guide is like, you know, the wind is coming over the top of that bowl canyon. And, you know, coming from Texas and even the places I've hunt, I've not had that geography type situation where the wind was basically boiling over the top, pushing the bullet, you know, down and away. And so it was one of those deals where I'm like, I was upset we missed, but at the same time, it's like that was such a rich learning moment for me.
Yeah.
And really got kind of into the wind thing. And I had a guy tell me one time, and I believe this wholeheartedly, is if you can look at the country you're shooting in and think about if God was to pour a big giant glass of water, what would that water do in that situation? And the wind is doing that to some extent, right? And that's been very, very helpful to me. And again, it's I hate to say guess and check, but it's guess and send it.
Yeah.
So.
But, yep, for sure.
So a couple of things here, and then we'll wrap up. But I wanted to ask you, you know, how's everything going in your space in the industry right now? Like, how is this year going? Like, you know, I know there's a lot of fears just in general out there, the economy, a lot of overstock. But at the same time, you know, we're rolling into the heart of hunting season, and you know, what are you seeing happening out there?
Yeah, you know, obviously there's still a very big demand for our product. You know, with the effects of COVID, you know, the lead times have really lengthened to time frames that are very, very difficult. You know, in some cases, you know, the lead time on certain products is, you know, almost a year. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really hard to forecast, you know, that far out. You know, especially since, you know, I think most of the industry for 2020 and 2021 was really, really strong as far as sales and demand. It seemed like the beginning of this year was still strong, but, you know, I think the economy took a pretty hard turn for the worse here in second quarter, and people, I think, are a little tighter with their money. At least that's what we're seeing overall. Thankfully, we're still having a really strong year. But, you know, the lead times and the ability to get product when you need it has been a challenge. I mean, we've got some products that, you know, one of our best-selling scopes, the 34mm 4.5-30x56 MOA ELR.
Yeah.
You know, we've been out of that scope for like 5 months, you know. Yeah, and it's tough when that's, you know, one of your top sellers. You can't
get. Yeah, that scope's like in the perfect groove. I was going to like write down the specs of what I wanted. Like what you read off is exactly.
Well, we've got the MRAD version in stock. And, you know, pretty much everything that we've got, I think that's the only scope that we don't have stock on right now. We'll have those, what is it, today's the 8th, we'll have those probably within 2 weeks.
Cool.
So we'll have everything in stock, you know, going into Black Friday and the Christmas season, which is great.
Cool.
You know, so yeah, thankfully it's going well. We've been having a nice strong year, And, you know, we've got some new products coming out next year that we're excited about. And, you know, that being said, we're going to need a rifle to pair it up with for photography
and
video.
I know a guy.
Do you? Okay. I figured you would. But, yeah, so, you know, in talking to other people, you know, I mean, we try to keep an eye on what's going on with some of the public companies and looking at, you know, the direction they're going. And, you know, a few of them have been down, you know, overall, you know, year to year. But, you know, we're still, I think we're an economy that, not an economy, excuse me, an industry that, you know, people have a passion for what they do, and they're going to find a way to do it. So,
exactly.
You know, whether you're hunting or shooting, it's, you know, it's, I think it's my vice, you know, people drink and gamble and they have other vices, and, you know, that's not me, it's shooting and hunting. So if I can continue to do that, that's what keeps me sane.
I hear you. I'm expressing that well this year. So for my boy's turning 10, and I drew a Montana elk and mule deer combo tag, and the opening to go was over his 10th birthday. So I was like, hey, buddy, I'm sorry. So we swapped tags this year. It's been kind of interesting. I had a New Mexico tag and got him on that tag and got his first elk on my birthday. And so now I'm going to go elk hunt on his birthday. But it's exactly like you say. That's the one area where, at least for me, that's the last thing to go, you know what I mean? So one thing we like to ask, with this being the Fanatic podcast, and we'll wrap up with this, and I'll ask you to answer, then I'll kind of answer where I'm feeling. But what does being Fanatic right now look like in your space in the industry, or for you personally?
You know, for me personally, it's just, you know, the passion for the sport, you know, whether it's, you know, hunting or shooting. You know, obviously hunting is somewhat limited in just the seasons, but, you know, thankfully, you know, you can shoot all year long. And, you know, that's my vice. That's the thing that I enjoy that helps me get out there and, you know, clear my head. And, you know, whether it's, you know, I'm a big bow hunter, so I shoot archery pretty much all year long. But, you know, I've been a center fire guy. I shoot a lot of clays, trap skeet, and sportings. You know, but I've really been a center fire guy. I've always owned rim fires, but I've never really gotten into the precision rim fire. And a buddy of mine, you know, has really been just, you know, breaking my chops to you know, get into shooting precision rim fire. And I did earlier this year, and Derek, I could tell you, I did not realize what I was missing, how much fun it is, how challenging it is. You know, you talked about wind, you know, I mean, you know, we're spotting behind the shooter and, you know, a gust of wind picks up and we're, you know, saying, hold. And, you know, the guy breaks the shot anyway. And, you know, through the spotting scope, you're literally seeing that bullet, you know, drift off. It's just, it's amazing. And, you know, I never really shot rim fires, you know, beyond 50 yards. It was always plinking and stuff like that. But, you know, at our range, we could shoot out to 200. So you really could see, you know, how the wind affects the bullet. And, you know, it's been a tremendous amount of fun. But, you know, again, I just think, you know, my son is, he's 19, and he's been very involved in football and wrestling. So we really haven't had a chance to go hunting much. But I took him spring turkey hunting. We had a phenomenal morning. We killed two turkeys before 6:30. So, you know, it's when you say, what is it about? It's, you know, it's about enjoying the time out in the field with, you know, the people you love, doing the things that you love. And, you know, that's really what, you know, it's all about, you know?
And I think that's how, you know, for me this week, I think that's how I'd answer that question in the same general kind of way. When I think about being Fanatic, it's like we talked about early on, I think you nailed it. It's really the experience of the whole thing, right? So it's not so much, you know, I've been blessed a lot where I've harvested a lot of animals, a lot of big whitetail, and a lot of this and that. And it's not so much about that. And the older I get and the more I do it and the more I see my son do it, it's that, you know, passing that that trait down, or passing that teaching down, or kind of like you said in your family, I think that's so cool, passing that property down, where being Fanatic becomes sort of a legacy, right? You know, and so that's what I think it means for me. Now, we'll say, guys, be sure, and as you take your hunting photos this year, especially with your tracked optics, be sure and post them on social and hashtag IAmFanatic, or go to IAmFanatic.com. Check out this podcast. Upload your hunting photos. And this year, at the end of the year, we will be selecting our favorite Fanatic photo, the photo that we think, you know, encompasses what being Fanatic looks like. And that person will be receiving one of our Fanatic X rifles in your caliber of choosing. So just a cool way to enter to win a rifle and express your being Fanatic. So now, John, I want to close here with, how do people find you, and what is the best way to get in touch with you guys to order one of your new scopes?
The best way to find us is just go to our website. It's trackedoptics.com, TrackedOptics.com. You know, if you need to call us, our phone number's there. We have a live chat that, you know, John and I try to be as accessible as possible. You could always email us. So, yeah, if you have any questions, you know, you could even go to our social media pages. We're on, you know, Facebook and Instagram, and I believe we're on TikTok and Twitter. And, you know, we're pretty easy to get a hold of, you know, and that's, you know, one of the things these days, just, you know, trying to get a hold of companies is getting harder and harder. And, you know, again, that's not the way we look at it. We want you to call us. We want you to, you know, chat with us. We want to help you any way we can.
Cool. Well, man, John, I really, really appreciate you being on this week. And guys, thanks for listening. And we'll catch you next week on another episode of the Fanatic Podcast. Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Fanatic Podcast with me, Derek Ratliff. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Be sure while you're out in the field to hashtag IAmFanatic for your chance to win one of our Fanatic rifles. And be sure and get out this week and be Fanatic.